Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Eugene McCaraher, Associate Professor of History and a faculty member in the Department of Humanities and Augustinian Tradition at Villanova University, as well as author of Christian Critics, Religion and the Impasse in Modern American Social Thought, and The Enchantments of Mammon, Corporate Capitalism and the American Moral Imagination. He'll speak on the topic, The Sign of the Dollar, the Pecuniary Metaphysics of Neoliberalism. His remarks were presented as the annual Kenefick Endowed Lecture in the Humanities. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, April 1st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Patrick Murray, holder of the John C. Kenefick Faculty Chair in the Humanities and Professor of Philosophy at Creighton University.
Dr. Eugene McCaraher is Associate Professor of Humanities and History and the Associate Director of the Honors Program at Villanova University. That's that other big East school out near Philadelphia. A professor at Villanova since the year 2000, he also taught history at Rutgers and at the University of Delaware, and religious studies at Princeton University. His study of liberal, Protestant, and Roman Catholic social and cultural criticism, called Christian Critics, Religion and the Impasse in Modern American Social Thought, was published by Cornell University Press in 2000. In addition to publishing scholarly articles in the Journal of the Historical Society, Modern Theology, and Modern Intellectual History, he's also written many essays and book reviews for Commonweal. That's actually where he got my attention. Books and Culture, Dissent, The Nation, In These Times, The Hedgehog Review, Raritan, and the Chicago Tribune. He's been a fellow of the National Endowment of the Humanities and of the American Council of Learned Societies. And he's just completed a second book, The Enchantments of Mammon, Capitalism as the Religion of Modernity. So, a warm welcome for Dr. Eugene McCaraher.
Good afternoon. First, let me thank Patrick and the Kenefick Advisory Board for inviting me to give the lecture at the luncheon today. I want to assure them, yes, indeed, yes, I did get my hair cut for this occasion. I want to begin by recalling a scene from a movie. I think it's one of the most prescient films ever made. Patty Chayefsky and Sidney Lumet's Network, which appeared in 1976. Now, those of us of a certain age might remember Peter Finch's Howard Beale, who's this unhinged news broadcaster who erupts one evening to tell everyone in a national audience, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take this anymore." Now, I'm not going to do that because I didn't bring a dirty raincoat with me, so I'm not going to do that imitation. But what I am going to do is relate a speech from later in the film. Eventually, this guy who becomes the mad prophet of the airwaves, as he's called, runs afoul of the corporate management of the television network for whom he works. And this executive's name is Arthur Jensen, and it's played in the film by Ned Beatty. I'm not even going to try to do justice to Ned Beatty's voice in this speech. He summons Beale to the corporate boardroom, and the corporate boardroom, by the way, is called Valhalla. And what he proceeds to do is explain the universe to Jensen after he's told him that he has, quote, meddled with the primal forces of nature. This is part of the speech that he gives. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There is only one holistic system of systems, one interwoven, interacting, multivaried, multinational dominion of dollars. It is the international system of currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. That is the natural order of things today. That is the atomic and subatomic and galactic structure of things today. Jensen then proceeds to expound some stark but intractable truths about the state of the world. The delusion, in his view, of democratic self-government. the open secret of corporate plutocracy, the supersession of all cultural and political limits on the power and authority of money. A Walt Whitman for a new Gilded Age, Jensen outlines his plutocratic vistas. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. These are the nations of the world today. We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world, Mr. Beale, is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. And I have chosen you, Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel, Jensen says as he touches the mad prophet's arm and anoints him the bearer of the gospel. I have seen the face of God, the demented herald murmurs. You just might be right, Mr. Beale, Jensen replies. Overcoming their perennial antipathy, God and mammon have finally merged into the largest monopoly ever contemplated. I want to suggest that Jensen's boardroom homily contains a quintessential statement of neoliberalism, and that neoliberalism has been far more than a mere revival of laissez-faire. As historians now agree, the genealogy of neoliberalism stretches back at least to the 1940s, when an aspiring bloc of business leaders and intellectuals hostile to the New Deal commenced an eventually successful crusade to recover the holy land of unfettered accumulation. Aided by conservative Protestant clergy, neoliberals slowly undermined and eventually overcame the New Deal order and European social democracy. At first, the relative prosperity and tranquility of what has been called the golden age of capitalism after World War II hindered their designs. But the global economic crisis of the early 1970s created auspicious conditions for a restoration of the ancien regime. Stagnation and falling profits provoked capital throughout the North Atlantic to unilaterally break the social truce between organized labor and corporate business. Spearheaded by Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan in the 1980s and brought to a head in the 1990s by Bill Clinton and Tony Blair, the ensuing 40-year assault on unions and the welfare state issued in a resounding victory for corporate business. In Thatcher's ominous declaration of triumph, there is no alternative, either in reality or in the imagination. As David Harvey writes, neoliberalism has been, quote, a utopian project to realize a theoretical design for the reorganization of international capitalism and a political project to reestablish the conditions for capital accumulation and to restore the power of economic elites. Just how utopian neoliberalism is has not, I think, until recently been appreciated. While historians like me have tended to emphasize political economy, the Notre Dame economist Philip Murawski has argued that neoliberals are much more ambitious in their aspirations. They seek, he writes, to reweave the entire fabric of society by increasingly erasing any distinctions among the state, society, and the market. Much more than a paradigm of politics and markets, neoliberalism names an attempt to remake all of human life in the crucible of accumulation, right down to the recesses of personal identity. In the neoliberal imagination, a human being is, in Murawski's words, an entrepreneurial self, a package of vendable talents and qualities, a product to be sold, a walking advertisement, a jumble of assets to be invested, an offsetting inventory of liabilities to be pruned, outsourced, shorted, hedged against, and minimized. Promulgating what he calls, in his words, a catechism of personal metamorphosis, neoliberalism denies the existence of any kind of true or invariant self and celebrates what he calls an eminently flexible personality, finely calibrated to deal with the unimpeachable vicissitudes of supply and demand. Neoliberal freedom, in other words, is absolute subservience to the dictates of the market. Although neoliberalism is often considered synonymous with business deregulation, its advocates have sought not so much to limit state power as to redirect it toward the promotion and extension of market activity. This is why we always wonder, why doesn't the government get any smaller? It's not intended to. Hence the privatization of many state services, the reconstruction of those remaining public to resemble the institutions of corporate enterprise, running government more like a business. The diminution of the state's welfare provisions and the dramatic augmentation of its capacities for coercion, surveillance, and punishment. And the insulation of the market itself from the nettlesome scrutiny and interference of democratic politics. But these goals emanate from a project whose objective is far deeper than the revival of laissez-faire and the liberation of capital from burdensome restraints. Where traditional liberals thought of the market and the state as two separate and antagonistic spheres, neoliberals seek to remake the state and everything else in the image and likeness of the market. That's why I think that Murawski's characterization of neoliberalism as a catechism is so incisive, for it suggests that neoliberalism, in fact, serves as a moral and metaphysical imagination. As Murawski puts it, neoliberals admonish the individual to relinquish her, quote, selfish arrogance and humbly prostrate before the wisdom of the universe. That's capital W, capital U. A wisdom contemplated with reverent awe by Friedrich Hayek and President Ronald Reagan. Justifying the ways of the market to mere mortals, Hayek once insisted that the spontaneous order of competitive enterprise must not be disrupted by fallible human judgments. And in a few moments, I'll be explaining just how spontaneous even Hayek did not think this order was. The wisdom of the market, in other words, is inscrutable yet beneficent. As President Reagan mused in 1982, there really is something magic about the marketplace when it's free to operate. Indeed, neoliberalism is, I would argue, a form of enchantment, the most comprehensive brand of pecuniary ontology yet seen in the history of economics. Now, I'm going to be encapsulating quite a lot of history in this lecture, but I want to identify three main sources of neoliberal metaphysics and morality. One is the gradual resurgence of evangelical Protestant religious culture from the 1950s to the 1970s. The rising hegemony of the Chicago school of economic thinking, epitomized by Hayek and Ludwig Mises, and the novels of Ayn Rand, the popular novelist and self-proclaimed philosopher, whose work has influenced high-level public figures from former Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan to Speaker of the House Paul Ryan. Convened under the sign of the dollar, an alliance of evangelical traditionalists and neoclassical innovators forged a pure culture of capitalism, a regime of pecuniary enchantment, a covenant theology of pure market power. Now, the renaissance of evangelicalism in the decades after World War II is a story in itself, but a significant chapter is the renewal of its longstanding love affair with capitalist enterprise, a friendship with the unrighteous mammon that stretches back to the Second Great Awakening. Rejecting New Deal liberalism as yet another metastasizing cancer of secular modernity, conservative Protestant writers such as Howard Kirshner, Leonard Reed, and R.J. Rushdoony, all connected to and promoted by an evangelical industrial complex of businessmen, clergy, academics, and politicians, all insisted that unregulated markets and capitalist property relations bore the mandate of heaven. A real estate broker, manufacturer, and virulent scourge of FDR, Kirshner, who once proudly proclaimed that he was a refugee from what he once called the Socialist Society of Friends, Kirshner was the editor of Christian Economics, a journal he founded in 1950 with subventions from J. Howard Pugh, Norman Vincent Peale, and other right-wing pastors and business leaders. In its pages, Kirchner evangelized that, quote, the laws of economics are part of the laws of God. In his best-selling book, God, Gold, and Government, published in 1957, one of the most popular economic tracts among conservative Protestants, Kirchner proclaimed a biblical imprimatur upon competitive gold money capitalism, embedding the free market and the Protestant work ethic in a theometallic metaphysics and cosmology. Since the universe is, quote, the handiwork of God, in Kirchner's words, economic laws are divine legislation. Conventional economic theory was a handmaiden of theology. Thus, as God's primer on all of creation, quote, the Bible is the greatest book on business ever written. Insisting on the moral and religious imperative of hard money financial policies, Kirchner considered a gold-backed dollar the only reliable currency of divine omnipotence. Kirchner's theo-capitalist metaphysics found expression in Leonard Reed's very strange essay, I Pencil, and not I Spy, I Pencil, first published in the libertarian periodical The Freeman in December 1958, and soon a classic of free market philosophy. As head of the Los Angeles Chamber of Commerce in the late 1940s, Reed began mobilizing other prominent Southern California businessmen for a pinstriped insurgency against reform and regulation. A capitalist manifesto for that movement, I Pencil espouses a metaphysics of laissez-faire, fusing theology and commercial cosmology in a narrative of what you could call market animism. Declaring itself, quote, a complex combination of miracles, Reed's Pencil, so the pencil is speaking in this manifesto, Reed's Pencil avowed, quote, the miraculousness which I symbolize, a wonder deriving not only from God, but even more from human fabrication. Quote, since only God can make a tree, the pencil insisted, only God could make me. God apparently meaning the entire process of production, something Reed asserted was more marvelous than divine creation itself. Quote, I am a mystery, more so than a tree or a sunset. The metaphysics of the market imparted this sublunary glamour to everyday objects, as well as reconciled the autonomy of individuals with the irrevocable laws of economics. When we hold a pencil as the outcome of an unplanned but beneficent mechanism, quote, we find the invisible hand at work. There's the invisible hand again. Orchestrating order from the apparent anarchy of self-interest. Where Reed and Kirchner relied on persuasion, Rush Dooney envisioned a libertarian theocracy. A refugee from the Armenian genocide of 1915, Rush Dooney was a prolific crusader for an assortment of right-wing causes, from unregulated business and white supremacy to homeschooling and creation science. Expounding what he called a dominion theology in his 1973 magnum opus, The Institutes of Biblical Law, Rush Dooney anchored capitalist enterprise in what he called dominion, man's, and I do mean man's, mandate from heaven to, quote, subdue the earth agriculturally, scientifically, culturally, artistically, in every way asserting the crown rights of King Jesus in every realm of life, end quote. Rooted in what Rush Dooney considered a male biological instinct of territoriality, a notion he picked up from, of all sources, the pop neo-social Darwinism of the anthropologist Robert Ardrey, acquisitiveness was, quote, God's creation ordinance. Godly men, Rush Dooney wrote, demonstrate their virtue through superior productivity. Sanctioning capitalism as a divine selection of the fittest, dominion theology mandated the complete release of business from almost all forms of restraint. Rush Dooney condemned taxation and welfare programs as forms of thievery, called for the elimination of the minimum wage, the criminalization of labor unions, the eradication of all anti-discrimination laws, and the restriction of the suffrage to male property owners. Democracy, he once wrote, was a demand from the losers. I just report the news, folks. During the 1950s and 1960s, Rushdoony was known primarily on the fringes of the Protestant right. But during the 1970s, many of his ideas found their way into the mainstream of evangelicalism. Now, evangelicals relied on Protestant theology for their pecuniary metaphysics and morality. An assortment of economists, philosophers, journalists, and other writers generated a more secular form of market cosmology. As hostile to the New Deal as evangelicals, they comprised the purest vanguard of neoliberalism. Even and perhaps especially when neoliberalism was purportedly secular or disenchanted, it divinized market forces and exalted the entrepreneurial self, marking, I think, the most complete apotheosis of pecuniary ontology in the history of economics. Where the Protestant acolytes of the market could trace its divinity to the will of God, the secular avant-garde of neoliberalism collapsed any distinction between the two. Aiming to refashion not only the state, but the moral and metaphysical imagination as well, neoliberals elevated the market to a position of absolute ontological sovereignty. In the neoliberal universe, the world, as Arthur Jensen said, is a business. Money is the measure of all things. Mercenary, professional, or technical talent is the existential equivalent of sanctity. And the successful entrepreneur is the autocratic icon of morality and beatitude. While many of the first neoliberals, especially Hayek, Mises, and Frank Knight, were openly scornful of Christianity and all other religions, I want to focus on Hayek and Mises, both because they were the most celebrated mandarins and because they raised neoliberal dicta to the register of ontology. Scoffing at what they consider the epistemological hubris of social democratic and socialist planners, neoliberals and others have praised Hayek for emphasizing the limits of human understanding. In this view, the humility enjoined by Hayek is the enabling virtue of capitalist markets, permitting the efflorescence of entrepreneurial ingenuity and the attainment of a, quote, spontaneous order without the peremptory ministrations of government. Yet Hayek himself, as I'll show, believed both that this spontaneous order of the market arose from human artifice and that this artifice must be concealed behind a haze of metaphysical enchantment. Hayek distinguished between what he called cosmos, the realm of impersonal spontaneous order, and taxis, the realm of conscious, deliberate construction. Now, to Hayek, the indeterminacy of cosmos constituted what, in his words, he calls a higher supra-individual wisdom, greater than that of any single human being or collective. Indeed, it is because, quote, we normally do not know who knows best, that most decisions should be left to, quote, a process we do not control. The metaphysical and vaguely theological character of cosmos could not be clearer, and Hayek did not hesitate to prescribe its import for political economy. He denounced the conviction, essential, he claimed, to any form of economic planning, that, quote, reason is capable of directly manipulating all the details of a complex society. In this view, even the most perspicacious experts could not foresee all contingencies, discern all connections, or identify all possibilities. Appalled at the insolence of bureaucrats, Hayek marveled at the felicitous ignorance of the market, and market and its competitors, quote, how little the individual participants need to know in order to be able to take the right action. What he called in The Road to Serfdom, quote, the impersonal and seemingly irrational forces of the market, became, in his philosophical writing, a cosmic, dispassionate, but progressive form of providence. Quote, it was men's submission to the impersonal forces of the market that in the past has made possible the growth of civilization. As the most dynamic of, quote, the products of spontaneous social growth, the incalculable market embodied the quintessence of cosmos. Any attempt, therefore, to accumulate knowledge or distribute it equally amounted, in Hayek's view, to a kind of act of ontological impertinence. Quote, an incomplete and therefore erroneous rationalism. Thus did the erudite liberal insist on ignorance and submissiveness as virtues. Quote, there is not much reason to believe, he wrote in 1960, that if at any one time the best knowledge which some possess were made available to all, the result would be a much better society. Although these statements have been lauded for their insight into human limitations and their preclusion of economic planning, it's important to emphasize that Hayek intended them to preempt any democratic restraint on the power of capital and its managerial or technocratic expertise. Quote, the best knowledge which some possess became a positive danger when exercised to regulate the economy in the interests of a democracy. Quote, it is at least possible in principle, he mused in 1967, that a democratic government may be authoritarian. Authoritarian defined very carefully as any prideful attempt to obstruct or modify the order of the market. If ignorance and submissiveness were virtues for ordinary people, Hayek made clear that business and the state had to know that conscious political choice lay behind the magic of spontaneous order. As he wrote in 1973, listen carefully to these words, an order which would have to be described as spontaneous may in fact rest on rules which are entirely the result of deliberate design. Thus, Hayek openly professed that liberalism was the most advanced form of class domination in history. Quote, a method of social control, he wrote in The Road to Serfdom, that should be deemed superior because of our ignorance of its precise results. Who had deemed the market order superior? All of us, according to Hayek. Quote, once we have agreed to play the game and profited from its results, it is a moral obligation on us to abide by the results, even if they turn against us. Now, I don't remember ever being consulted about this agreement. I must have missed the memo at some point. But that's not, I think, the most important objection to this. Hayek erases the distinction between liberty and compulsion in the mechanisms of the market. If we, quote, freely submit to the adjustments which the market forces upon us, Hayek implicitly admitted that the market was a latticework of coercions from which the powerless were unable to dissent. Seldom has capitalism been characterized so aptly as a command economy of freedom. What if the market's losers reject the edicts of the market and its unaccountable will? Well, Hayek proposed that the authoritarian nature of the free market could be shrouded most effectively in the incense of religion and tradition. The same Hayek who wrote that capitalism has been stunted, quote, by those very morals preached by prophets and philosophers. Indeed, he continued, quote, modern civilization has become largely possible by the disregard of these indignant moralists. This is the same Hayek who aligns religion and tradition with the imperatives of market cosmology. Quote, submission to undesigned rules and conventions whose significance and importance we largely do not understand, or at least to those described as spontaneous. Quote, this reverence for tradition is indispensable for the working of a free society. Hayek openly acknowledged that the rules of competitive enterprise endure both because, quote, the groups who observed them were more successful and displaced others, and because those winners draped their triumph in the robes of tradition and custom, the raiment of reverence that repels the scrutiny of reason. And if tradition and custom fail, God can be recalled from his metaphysical oblivion. Dismissive of religion when it inhibited the progress of commerce and technology, Hayek conceded its utility in upholding the foundations of capitalist civilization. Religion itself depended, to Hayek, on its instrumental value in preserving bourgeois morality. Quote, the only religions that have survived, he reflected late in his life, are those which support property and the family. What more utilitarian standard could you apply? Mises was especially blunt about the metaphysical and moral lineaments of neoliberal economics. Mises is a very refreshing writer. He's refreshingly blunt and candid, where Hayek is oracular a lot of the time. More pointedly than Hayek, in fact, Mises identified human rationality with pecuniary calculation, asserting that, quote, without economic calculation, there can be no economy. Mises argued that economic calculation can proceed only in monetary terms. In a, quote, competitive society, he wrote, money's central role was in determining the value of production goods. In the absence of a competitive market whose processes were quickened and ordered by money, quote, there would be no means of determining what was rational. Thus, to Mises, without money, it is impossible to speak of rational production. Rational defined in pecuniary terms. The entire argument turns on a subtle conflation of reason with monetary valuation. If, as Mises stated so unequivocally, money determined both the value and the rationality of human creativity, then both morality and reason were defined in its terms. The magnitude of this neoliberal transvaluation of values was evident to Mises, who insisted that all obstacles to efficiency and expansion had to be summarily obliterated. Quote, no religious or ethical tenet can justify a policy that aims at the substitution of a social system under which output per unit of input is lower for a system in which it is higher. No religious or moral tenet. Mises' remarks on Adam Smith and John Ruskin underscored the breadth of this neoliberal moral revolution. As imperishable as Adam Smith's work would remain, even he, Mises lamented in 1957, could not, quote, free himself from the standards and terminology of traditional ethics, which set limits on material accumulation. As for the art critic Ruskin, whose eloquent indictment of liberal industrialism in Unto This Last earned Mises indomitable hatred, Mises declared that, quote, judgment about the merits of a work of art is entirely subjective. There is no yardstick to measure the aesthetic worth of a poem or of a building. No yardstick that is other than money, the most effective measure of loveliness. Quote, what counts in the frame of the market economy, Mises pronounced about art, are, quote, the valuations actually manifested by people in buying or not buying. Outside of money, there is no beauty. What remained Mandarin and recondite with Hayek and Mises became colorful and popular with Ayn Rand. Though an avowed and truculent atheist, Rand knew that the market was an ontology and morality to replace the old enchantment. Quote, a new faith is needed, as she confided in her journals, a definite positive set of new values and new interpretation of life. We will give people a faith, she once wrote to a friend, a positive, clear, and consistent system of belief. Objectivism was, as she put it, a spiritual, ethical, philosophical groundwork for the belief in the system of free enterprise. One of the many heralds of the death of God, Rand was indeed a pioneer in her nomination of the dollar as a worthy and durable surrogate. At the tawdry conclusion of Atlas Shrugged, for instance, John Galt traces the sign of the dollar, not the sign of the cross, in the empty heavens. The moral ecology of Rand's objectivism is thoroughly mercantile. Commodity exchange is the exclusive and unforgiving paradigm of human life. As the copper tycoon Francisco D'Anconia, love for those names, says in Atlas Shrugged, money is the barometer of virtue. And I might add, he is echoing here Ralph Waldo Emerson. Like Hayek and the principle of cosmos, Rand sublated the trucking and bartering of the market into a universal catechism. Trade, she believed, is, quote, the only rational ethical principle for all human relationships, personal and social, private and public, spiritual and material. The Randian individual, quote, does not seek to be loved for his weaknesses or flaws, only for his virtues. A meticulous accountant of morality, he, quote, earns what he gets and does not give or take the undeserved. Unlike saints or other moochers, one of Rand's sharper reproaches, Randian individuals seek the only real meaning of life in exchange value and rates of profit. Quote, we exist for the sake of earning rewards, as Galt explains to a puzzled audience. As Rand's disquisition on love demonstrates, neoliberal morality is market activity without the market's Protestant God. For Rand, the most intimate affairs find their finest consummations in a monetary nexus. Love and friendship, she argued, constitute, her words, spiritual payment, tendered for, the, quote, the personal, selfish pleasure which one man derives from the virtues of another's character. With a soul reduced to the utility preferences of asset and liability calculation, Rand's conditional lover is an austere precursor of the neoliberal entrepreneurial self. That's why I think Rand's atheism scandalized the post-war right. Not so much on its own account. The right, it's worth remembering, has had its own unbelievers. But because it threatened the alliance of American Christianity and capitalism. Rand denigrated Christianity, in her words, the best kindergarten for communism possible. Thank you, Ian, for its exaltation of charity. In her journal, she railed against charity as a dangerous and even sinister practice, as Christians and other promiscuous lovers of humanity threatened to erase those distinctions of merit necessary for any social order. Charity, Rand asserted, should be bestowed like gold from a tightwad's purse. It should mark and augment both the power of the giver and the impotence of the recipient. Quote, charity to an inferior does not include the charity of not considering him an inferior, she explained. The lowly object of charity should, quote, remember and acknowledge his position. To give anyone something for nothing was a kind of cruelty, Rand argued, an act of malice inflicted on the meritorious. Quote, the ultimate viciousness of charity, she reflected, lay in its cavalier indifference to achievement as a criterion of human worth. Quote, ignoring his actual worth as a man, a worth determined, as in Mises' moral economy, in the competitive marketplace. One hands to the weak, quote, the moral and spiritual benefits, such as love, respect, consideration, which better men have to earn. This is a beatific vision for neoliberal Ubermenschen, and evidence of a covert Randian theology lies in plain sight in her earliest novels. In The Fountainhead, Rourke, whom his lover Dominique describes as having the face of a god, concurs with one critic who observes that he is, quote, a religious man in your way. I can see that in your buildings. Rourke's religion is his own creativity. Creators, he declares, have never depended on anyone, as, quote, the whole secret of their power is that it is, like divinity, quote, self-sufficient, self-motivated, self-generated. Every creator, in Rand's words, is a prime mover. But Rand's most explicit theological avowals appeared in Anthem, a seminal, if little discussed, dystopian tale written in 1937 but published in 1946 by, to bring all of this together, our friend Leonard Reed, author of I, Pencil, an acolyte of evangelical enchantment. Having discovered the word I, and I is a word that's forbidden by the elders who run the stagnant world in this novel, the protagonist, who is originally named, I don't know where she comes up with these things, Equality 26371. The protagonist, whoever, renames himself Prometheus, thief of the arts of civilization from the stingy Olympians. Like all subsequent Randian heroes, Prometheus recites a creed of undaunted individualism, tracing his moral and metaphysical roots to the mundane fact of his existence. Prometheus sacralizes everything he touches, first and foremost of all, himself. Quote, "My happiness needs no higher aim to vindicate it," he reasons, "since he belongs entirely to himself. I need no warrant for being and no word of sanction upon my being. I am the warrant and the sanction," which thereby makes him his own object of worship. "This miracle of me is mine to own and keep and mine to guard and mine to use and mine to kneel before." Thus Rand bestows divinity on the individual ego. This God, this one word, I. Where Christian charity emanated from thanksgiving for the gift of existence, Promethean liberty stems from a principled ingratitude. "I owe nothing to my brothers," he announces. "I do not gather debts from them." Later in The Fountainhead, Rourke would mark his territory with a bit more contumely. "I do not recognize anyone's life right to 1 minute of my life. I am a man who does not exist for others." Like Rand herself, Prometheus redefines brotherly love as reward for achievement or services rendered. "Other people must earn my love," he says with all the lyricism of a miser. This is Arthur Jensen's Dominion of Dollars, a world animated and governed by the unchanging and implacable gravitational principles of money. And at this point in our history, even in the midst of the most prolonged crisis in capitalism since the 1930s, it's the regnant moral and metaphysical imagination of our ruling classes. Thus, those who seek any alternative to the neoliberal paradise must counter it with a vision at least as enchanting. Perhaps we might look again to Network, but this time to Howard Beale. In one scene, his friend Max Schumacher, concerned that Howard is going mad, tells him that he needs professional psychiatric treatment. "No," Beale responds, "I'm experiencing an epiphany." And this is what Beale then proceeds to say. "I feel vivid and flashing, as if suddenly I'd been plugged into some great electromagnetic field. I feel connected to all living things, to flowers, birds, all the animals of the world, and even to some great unseen living force, what I think the Hindus call prana. It is not a breakdown. I've never felt more orderly in my life. It is a shattering and beautiful sensation. It is the exalted flow of the space-time continuum, save that it is spaceless and timeless, and of such loveliness." Beale collapses to the floor, unconscious. His epiphany appears to be little more than psychological exhaustion. Yet this shattering and beautiful sensation hints at an alternative to Jensen's pecuniary cosmology. Both men envision the world as a web of vast metaphysical networks, one determined by the laws of accumulation and the other aligned by the charisma of loveliness. It's a vision worthy of William Blake or Gerard Manley Hopkins, the world charged with the grandeur of God. And I think it's the soul of our only hope against the dominion theology of mammon. But that's a subject for another luncheon. Thank you.
There's so many striking things. It's hard to pick which one to ask you about. But the first thing I want to ask is, why is this? I love it pitched as a theology or a cosmology. I just have never thought about it that way before, and it's the right way to think about it. I quite think. Why is it attractive? Right. So that I don't see. I don't see what's attractive about
short
feeling.
Answer, the short answer, and I'm not, is original sin. And I think in a way that's the basic answer. That's the fundamental answer. The historical answer, I think, my God, I would say there's a book coming out called The Enchantments of Mammon, probably next year, soon to be at fine bookstores near you, if there are any left. I'll explain a lot of it there. I'll give what I think really is the fundamental answer and then historicize it a bit more. The fundamental problem, I think, is that the pecuniary imagination is a perversion of what I'm calling in the book the sacramental imagination. The idea that, as Catholics would put it, right, that the material world is a medium or a kind of a vehicle for the expression of divinity, that this kind of dualism that we often think about is not really true. And so I think that in many ways neoliberal economics is sort of the apotheosis of that kind of perversion, right? I mean, so in other words, Max Weber was wrong, right? The world has not been disenchanted. What's happened is we've replaced it with surrogates, right? One is money, one could be the nation state, one, you know, we've had a succession of substitutes, I think, about this. So that's kind of the meta answer. Right, so that's what I think the perversion is. I think that this kind of thing also has very deep roots in American history, all the way back to the 17th century to the Puritans. I think that that's why I think the evangelical alliance with this is not at all to be wondered at. It's actually quite deep in roots our history, I think, which in one level makes it a sad, tragic tale because you think, okay, so what's going to happen? But I do think that there's been this kind of sacramental lineage stretching from England. You know, people like John Ruskin, I think, is very important in this regard. But in the United States, there has also been this lineage of critics of capitalism who have not seen it in secular terms, right, who have seen it as, in fact, this kind of perversion. And so they pitched their criticism accordingly. That's one of the reasons I don't think Marxism has had much play in the United States, because Marxism itself is a secular account of secularism, right? It shares many of the features of its capitalist antagonist, which is why it will not succeed.
At one point, as you were telling the story surrounding von Mises, a question arose for me, and I don't think I can situate it very well in your talk, but to what extent do you think that the desire for a strong kind of objectivity of value motivates the attractiveness of an economic theory of value? That is, all value can be determined by its monetary equivalent. It seems to me that the threat of subjectivism, in part, makes that an attractive account of value. What do you think about that?
Well, I think Mises is, in fact, he says it himself, right, that he thinks that value is purely subjective, which makes it basically a question of power. I think that in some ways Hayek and Mises and even Rand are fundamentally Nietzscheans in some way. They're not nihilists. They do believe in some kind of value. That value, however, has to do with the power of the actors. And in this case, you know, the power that they are able to both wield and betoken with money. The idea that objectivity is something that you can only determine by money, I think, again, once you've kind of jettisoned some other kind of avowedly enchanted metaphysic, right, then what are you left with? You're just left with power. Whether it's expressed through money, whether it's expressed through, you know, glamour, you know, whatever. I think one thing I guess I'm trying to do is take seriously and run with Terry Eagleton's kind of insight in culture and the death of God. I mean, this is how he sees culture, or the modern understanding of culture, which is, well, once you get rid of God, what do? You keep finding surrogates. And, you know, it's like, what is it, Pascal's old, you know, it's just Pascal all over again. Once you get rid of God, well, something's got to fill the vacuum. So money, nation state, art for many in the 19th century. Yeah, I mean, what's interesting in this regard is that William Morris, who is a kind of a hero of this book, I think that for him and for a lot of other critics of industrialism in the 19th century, art became the substitute enchantment. Right. So if we have art, capital A, if we have a revival of arts and crafts, well, that will do it. I mean, okay, great. Arts and crafts, yeah, you know, with you, comrade. But I don't know if art itself can do it. I don't know if that answers or evades your question, but did my best.
My question maybe takes us back closer to yours. You used the term exchange value at some point, and along the line, classical political economy makes the distinction between use value and exchange value. And this is coming back, and I'm interested in ecological questions with the Lauderdale paradox, and who first formulated this. But so somewhere along the line, the development of mainstream neoclassical economics obliterates this distinction by definition. Did that point in historical time fit into this narrative that you found?
That I think is something that occurs before Hayek and Mises. One thing to keep in mind about Hayek is that Hayek was not trained as an economist. Hayek was trained as a philosopher, specifically a political philosopher. So I think that's actually one of the reasons why Hayek's work has been so crucial, because you don't actually find a lot of economics in it. What's curious about this? Mises is just a straight, flat out man. Exchange value and use value are the same thing. You know, it's just assumed, right? And if you try to make any distinction, well, you're a Marxist. You're a filthy Marxist, right? So one way in which neoclassical economics sets itself up as a science, right, is to say that, well, Marxism, that's just ideology, right? And what's kind of curious in this regard, right, is that what neoclassical economists forget is that Capital has a subtitle, right? It's called A Critique of Political Economy. So what they're trying to do there is basically insulate themselves from any kind of criticism. This is why it's often so difficult to talk to neoclassical economists of any kind, because how do you get in? Can't. So why bother?
I guess going back to the question earlier, Celeste, and the first response thing that strikes me is that subjectivism that underlies the whole neoclassical economics, that it's all about preferences. And satisfying your preferences. There's really no, I mean, in terms of, you know, and that of course throws everything back on yourself. So a lot of the things that you talked about, they're no wonder when you come from that. There's, and it just seems to me, you know, compared to a kind of view from classics from the humanities or from the Catholic tradition, what could be more fundamentally at odds with it than a view that really begins with the idea that there's really no objectivity to good or bad values whatsoever, and that all there really is are subjective preferences and the idea trying to maximize the satisfaction of those?
Mises is very clear. I didn't quote him for this talk. But he does say something to the effect in one of his books that this notion of a hierarchy of values, we got to jettison that. mean, you just cannot have a free market where you have a hierarchy of values. You just can't do it. Where I think the way he put it is any system of ethics which has a hierarchy of values is incompatible with the workings of a market economy. I mean, there it is. You couldn't be clearer.
Well, and I think we see in the Pope's encyclical the flip side of that. If you have those objectives, then you can't. If you hold to objective values, then you can't just accept an unregulated market. I think he's pretty clear on that. So, well, I know we all have other things to do today, and I want to thank everyone for coming out, and I want to especially thank our speaker, Gene McCarraher.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Eugene McCarraher, Associate Professor of History and a faculty member in the Department of Humanities and Augustinian Tradition at Villanova University, as well as author of Christian Critics, Religion and the Impasse in Modern American Social Thought, and The Enchantments of Mammon, Corporate Capitalism and the American Moral Imagination. He spoke on the topic, The Sign of the Dollar, the Pecuniary Metaphysics of Neoliberalism. His remarks were presented as the annual Kenefick Endowed Lecture in the Humanities. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Friday afternoon, April 1st, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.